Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with gardening expert and UPR friend Dan Drost. He's joining us to answer your gardening questions. Whether you've got a large backyard garden or participate in a community garden, or maybe you have a small box near your window, Dan can help. You can get your question into us right now to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. We're also bringing back the phone number. Haven't used this in a while, and this particular number we have not used before.
Oh,
800 numbers are gone the way of the dodo,
yeah,
Dan.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So we still have the 800 number, but for these purposes in this show, here's the number, 435-797-8877, 435-797-8877. I'll say that once again, 435-797-8877. Or you can go to upraccess@gmail.com. Dan Drost is Emeritus Professor of Horticulture and Extension Vegetable Specialist in the Department of Plants, Soils, and Climate at Utah State University. Longtime contributor to Utah Public Radio, giving us gardening advice on segments such as The Green Thumb. And back in studio, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's always good to come in and have a chat with the audience. I did this for a lot of years, as you well know, and so, you know, it's kind of fun, actually, to spend an hour with you and spend an hour with the NPR audience, who I'm quite interested in. And so certainly for our Utah listeners and those that are in adjoining states that happen to hear our program, the information, I think, will be applicable to them as well.
Certainly true. So now that it's raining, and we haven't seen that in so long, I want to start with water, because we've been in the middle of it. Drought. It's been horrible. So one question I had was, should we even have a garden in the middle of a drought? I guess you want to eat produce anyway, and you spend water California or water here, I guess, right?
Well, it's kind of the question of, to me, has always been that you can make the desert flourish. It only takes water and a little bit of work. We get plenty of sun. We get plenty of warmth, but sometimes it's a little bit too warm, and we've had those kinds of issues. I went out and looked at my rain gauges this morning. I have several rain gauges scattered around my property, and that then helps me get an idea of what the rain looked like, and I had about 0.2 inches.
Okay.
So, you know, it's barely enough to wet the grass, let alone seep into the soil, particularly
right.
If the soil is really dry. So coming back to your question, should we have a garden? All I have to do is go to the grocery store, or all I have to do is listen to my spouse, Dawn, say, you know, those produce prices are pretty high, and we never used to pay that much for this. And we all know that, you know, food prices have kind of jumped. So actually a garden makes a little bit of sense.
Mm.
And you might say that in some ways preserving some of that, whatever way you do that, if you freeze it or you can it or you just consume it, I always think it's a good investment myself. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think, should we have a garden? Yeah, why not?
Okay.
The question then becomes what I always used to say to my students. I said, a garden can be just about anything you want it to be. It can be a pot that has one plant in it that's producing some tomatoes or some basil for you, or it could be, you know, a third of your landscape where you're really trying to feed your family with it. So a garden can be anything you want it to be. There's no defined definition of it other than it's a plant that I want to grow and I want it to do something for me and I want it to be bountiful. I want it to produce a lot for me so that I can get some benefit out of it.
So, how to be water wise in our gardens? Give us some tips.
Well, yeah, I think first of all is you know, think about how much water is being put out there. I have a neighbor. It's a rental property. The owner of the property comes along in late April, turns the irrigation system on for the lawn, and then comes in late October and turns it off and never, ever looks at what's going on. So the system runs for a half hour. It runs every day. And it oversprays into my yard. Now, I'm benefiting from that because I love the overspray. So I basically have adjusted my irrigation schedule in those areas that get overspray to deal with that kind of issue. But it does create a problem for me because it's also sprays into part of my garden. And there are things that I have to think about in terms of trying to ensure that those plants don't get over-irrigated, which is really possible, particularly when somebody's watering for a half hour a day, every day of the week, from late April till October. And so that's kind of an issue for me that I have to deal with. So I'm kind of trying to mitigate that. So water conservation then comes in thinking about, A, the duration of water, the frequency of water, and then what you can do to mitigate the loss of water out of the system. Now, a natural way for plants to lose water is to suck it up and transpire it back into the atmosphere. That helps to cool the plant, and that's a good thing. But if I don't put enough on, then the plants don't thrive. If I put on too much, they don't thrive. So I got to try and work that out. And one of those methods is to try and know how much water is lost from the landscape in a day. And generally during the July and August period when it's the hottest, it's about a third of an inch of water a day that is being lost back to the atmosphere through evaporation off the surface of off the leaves. If it's wet, like today, the leaves are wet and they don't take much up that way. They just lose it back to the atmosphere. Or through the transpiration process where it comes in through the root system and then goes out through pores in the leaf. So if we know that about a third of an inch of water is being lost a day, what can I do to try and reduce one of those components? I really can't reduce transpiration that much, but I can reduce evaporation. And so the methods that are being suggested are to, A, if you're sprinkling over the surface of the water or flooding it, try to use as much mulch on the surface of the soil so that the water stays on the surface and it doesn't just evaporate back to the atmosphere, or to use some kind of drip system that allows the water to get right to where the plant is needing it and not wetting the whole garden, but just watering the rows, which is kind of the approach that I have taken. So I have, you know, dripper lines. Some of them are just like soaker hoses that I lay adjacent to the plants, and that just wets that area, and then it flows into the soil right where the plant is, and the areas that are my footpaths are generally pretty dry, which allows me to just get access to the garden without having mud, and no one wants to track mud around, and certainly there are days when you're going to need to pick when it's a little bit wet. So there's things that I can do in the garden to try and actually conserve water.
Talk about stresses, especially in vegetables. I'd imagine, you know, the heat we've been experiencing is a stressor.
Yeah, you know, it comes back to the system of gardening is not as simple as putting a seed in the ground and then coming back several months later and harvesting something. There's a lot more to it than that. And certainly our soils tend to be more on the sandy to the loamy side, though in areas we have soils that are very clayey. Those ones that have a lot of clay in them hold a lot of water, but don't often necessarily supply a lot of water to the plant. So you still need to water them frequently. And the sandy soils dry out a little bit faster, so you have to water them frequently. And therefore, if plants aren't getting the water they need, stresses actually become a reality. And plants react differently to those types of stresses. And some of those things, you see it as you know, the plant's leaves tend to tip downward. They're flagging, we call that. You know, like a limp flag on a flagpole, that's what they look like because they're not getting enough water. So that's a symptom that you can visually see, but not all plants show that. Some plants also curl up a little bit. They tend to fold their leaves into each other. A corn plant does that. Sometimes a tomato plant does that. And that's a sign that the plant is under stress. And then if you have other plants like carrots, my carrots rarely show any water stress, but you'll see it in terms of how the root system fills out. And so you don't get that nice elongated carrot that you're expecting because A, it might be too dry at depth so the root can't grow there, or it just doesn't swell as we would expect it to swell over time. So we've got all these different things that you have to start to look for. But if you see those stress events, it's already too late. And so what we're trying to do with our irrigation in our vegetable garden is we want to maximize productivity and we want to minimize all these other factors that cause the plant to be less productive.
Yeah. I'll mention several times through the program, I'm sure you would endorse this, USU Extension has all sorts of information.
Yeah. If you have not gone to the Extension Service's website yet, and there's a front page tab that basically says lawns and gardens, you need to go there. You need to really look at that. The number of people that come up to me each week and go, oh, you're Dross, you wrote all those extension publications. Well, there's a whole lot of people like me up at the that were like me up at the university, and there's people still there that are doing those kinds of things. They're trying to provide information to the public that's going to be helpful to them. And so it could deal with your whole landscape. So if you're having a problem with a tree, you need to go find the stuff on trees. If you're having problems with your perennial plants or your flowers, there's people that will help you with that. There's information that's available there that will help you get started, and if you can't figure it out from there, then each county has an extension service, and they have someone knowledgeable in that county that can then direct you to the resources that you're going to need. And if they can't answer your question, then they have the backup of the people at the university that they can get that information from. So in a very timely fashion, that kind of thing can happen. And an example of that is yesterday, Dawn said, oh, I've ordered some green beans for canning, but I'm not certain that the pressure canner is working properly. Can you, check it out for me? And I said, well, I can't check it out, but I know someone in the extension office that can. So I took the lid to the canner to the extension service down in Cache County here, and they did a pressure test online, and they gave it a star that said it's working like it's supposed to. Not only that, they gave me this really nice sheet of paper that said, oh, this is what we now recommend based on USDA and on local standards as to how long you should process all the different crops that you might be canning over the year. And we generally only can tomatoes and beans. Dawn loves canned green beans, and she loves to have crushed tomatoes in a jar that she can use in soups and in stews and in all the other things that one cooks. And she just likes to do it that way because that's something that, her and her sisters and her parents, they always did it anyway. And so, yeah, so those are the kinds of things. But what a great service. And I took it in, and in 5 minutes, the young lady in the office said to me, oh, it works perfectly. You're good to go. If it didn't work, they would have given me explanations as to, go buy a new regulator or fix this part on it, rather than buying a whole new machine. I just needed to buy a little part, which are readily available around at places in any community. So you can do this almost in any extension office throughout the whole state. So you have the resources that are there. You just need to go and use them and seek them out.
Yeah, there's a lot of resources here. I went to earlier today, I went to extension.usu.edu/yardandgarden, and they have fruits, vegetables, or herbs. Each have a sheet on this, so I clicked tomatoes, how to grow tomatoes in your garden. You got a summary, tomato varieties, all kinds of advice.
It's A to Z, you start from the beginning and you work to the end. And so, as we're thinking about what you're going to do this year, the main thing that I think our problem has been this year has been water, and we know that, and we're going to kind of come back to water because you asked me about stresses, and I didn't really talk about what some of the manifestations of the stresses are in plants. But for our vegetable crops, the one that most people see in tomato is a little brown or black spot on the bottom of the tomato fruit. So I pulled up a couple in my own garden, And I have a few where the overlap isn't quite perfect. I'm relying a lot on my neighbor, as I said, and I'm trying to supplement a little bit with my own. And if I'm not careful, and I was away for a couple of weeks, and so I didn't do any supplemental irrigation, and yeah, sure enough, I picked a couple ripe fruits. They looked perfectly good on the top. I flipped them over, and they had this little brown spot around where the flower attaches, and that brown spot is called blossom end rot. And the symptom is that the plant at some stage during the development of that fruit wasn't getting enough water. And I was away, so I mean, I kind of knew it. Now, other plants that were in the tomato patch were perfectly fine, had lovely large fruited tomatoes and good color and the excellent flavor that I was expecting them to have. But that blossom end rot is a symptom of a failure to provide enough water to the plant at a particular stage in the development of the flower. Now, another symptom one might see on tomatoes is you might actually have a flower truss, which has multiple blooms on it. And then if you look at it carefully, you will see that some of the blooms didn't set and the flower fell off. And normally on a larger fruited type variety, you should have about 4 or 6 fruits on that that will fill out. And if you only have 2 or 3, and if you look closely at it, you'll see that some of them aborted, they fell off, and that's usually a symptom of water stress as well. Okay, so that's those are two things in tomatoes that are pretty prevalent, but you also see those in peppers. You'll also see those same symptomology in some of your squashes, both summer squash and winter squash, and all of those things together and reduce the productivity of the plant. And what you're trying to do is you spend a lot of effort getting that plant to that flowering stage. Now I want those flowers to produce something that I can consume. And so that's important for us to understand that those stresses are relatively real. And this year, being as hot as it's been for the duration of that warm period that we have, and then combined with the dryness there, I had some relative humidities in my yard on my weather station that said we were in the 8% relative humidity. That plant needs a lot of water in order to make it. And so sometimes you actually have to supplement a little bit more just to keep that plant going. And if you can do that, then the garden can be very productive.
If you just joined us, we're talking with gardening expert Dan Drost. And Dan is answering your questions. We'll talk about general topics, but if you have a specific question related to your garden, we'd love to have Dan answer that. And a couple ways you can do that: by email to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or our phone number will get you right to the studio, 435-797-8877, 435-797-8877. That's 435-797-8877. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking gardening today. And we have gardening expert Dan Drost with us. He can answer your questions. We're talking gardening in general, but I'd love to answer your specific question. Here's your opportunity. And you can call us to 435-797-8877. 435-797-8877. 435-797-8877, or email us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Love to answer your gardening question. So then mid-August now, I did have a question before we get into harvesting. I imagine we'll get to harvesting a little bit here. Can I plant anything right now?
Tom, you can plant a lot of stuff.
Hey,
and now is the time to get on it.
Yeah.
I got back from holiday a week ago or thereabouts. I went to visit some family back in the Midwest and spent some time on the water at my brother-in-law's cabin, and we had a lovely time there. But I was thinking all the time that I was out there, I got to get things started when I get back. And so on our ride back, Dawn says to me, "Oh, what are we going to get into the garden?" And I said to her, "Well, I have one more planting of beans." And so if you live here in, you know, central to northern Utah, get your last planting of beans in the ground now. I have a 55-day variety that I grow, If I plant it around the first week of August to the 15th of August, in that range, usually it's starting to produce some beans for me right around early October. And now is a great time to do that. So then I'll have some late fall beans. And I plant usually a 4 foot, 2 4-foot rows, and I have enough for the table through the fall. So I planted my beans. Back in early July, I had a little spot in my flower beds, and so I planted some broccoli seed in that, and I got some broccoli transplants started. So as soon as I came back, I transplanted those broccoli plants, which were about, they were about 4 inches tall. They had about 3 leaves on them. I put those in the garden, and I've been a little concerned about them because it's been so hot, so a couple nice days of cool weather here, but I watered them carefully. I kept putting a little water to them every day to where those plants were. They took off, and I can start seeing them grow already. And so that'll be some broccoli plants that will be producing broccoli heads for me in October as well, which most times we have a little bit of a frost, sometimes maybe late September, early October. But generally, it's not very bad. And what I do with my beans is I just throw something over the top of them. I watch the weather. My broccoli, I don't even need to worry about that. Now, about the 15th of the month here in August, throughout northern and central Utah, I plant lettuce, I plant spinach, I plant radishes, I'm planting mustards, I'm planting carrots. I'm doing some of those other, you know, quick crops that can come on, leafy greens. Dawn has said that she is not buying lettuce because she's afraid of this, you know, lettuce scare that's going on. And it's real. And so if you go to the grocery store, there's not a lot of lettuce in the thing there, and she's not buying it. She says, we're not having it. But I have chard, and I have kale, and I have a few of these other greens that are, you know, take the heat a little bit better than lettuce does. But by seeding some lettuce within about 3 weeks, I really will have a lot of lettuce and the other veggies that I want. And so hopefully by then the scare will have been gone. They'll sort out what the problem was, and we'll feel some confidence into being able to purchase, you know, lettuce-based products again in the landscape. So I'll be doing that type of stuff. I'm also planting parsley and cilantro and a few of the other crops that have gone to seed on me because of the heat and because of long days. So as the summer progresses and the days get longer and longer, many plants are triggered to stop growing vegetatively and then switch over to reproduction. Also with the heat, we get some stresses on many plants, and so they take on bitter flavors. So while I had a great crop of all those leafy greens in the spring, by late June, early July, they were not so good anymore, so they just kind of go off the menu. And now if it's also too hot to actually plant them in the middle of the summer, so I start planting them again in early August to mid-August, and I'll then have myself, you know, plenty of that kind of stuff to put on my dinner plate. And there's really nothing like, you know, having some fresh lettuce to, you know, round out a meal. We're harvesting carrots right now, plenty of those. I've got lots of kale, lots of chard. Of course, the tomatoes are, you know, a bumper crop this year. The peppers are doing great, and they've been providing us with, you know, more than adequate amounts of stuff so that we can put them in various dishes and that type of stuff. The zucchini, of course, is always more productive than you want it to be. So one of the approaches that I take with zucchini is I always overplant it, but if I have too much, I just kind of let the fruits get big. And what that does is it stops them from producing more female flowers where the fruit is until I cut that big one off. And then all of a sudden they just trick them back into producing again. And so we were away. I had invited my neighbors to help themselves to the garden. Of course, they aren't gardeners, so they forget and they don't come over. And so I had all of this stuff in the garden that could have been used but wasn't. And so it kind of, you know, we're short on zucchini right now, but I was looking at the plants, and by Monday or by, you know, the weekend, I should have plenty of zucchini again, both green and yellow. So those are then just a question of when you harvest them, how big do you want them to be? Little ones, mid-sized ones. We had a couple of very large ones, and so We found a nice dish that had stuffed zucchini with lamb and curry, and it had peach and cranberries in it, and that was the stuffing, and it was spectacular. And Don says, I think we can make that one again. And I said, I don't normally let the zucchinis get that big, but the ground lamb and the peach and the cranberry and, you know, of course, onion and a few other things in there kind of rounded that out. And so you had that luscious, you know, kind of baked shell that got all this stuffing in it. And, she said, I think that's a keeper recipe. And so it was like when you never know when you try a new recipe, is it going to be a keeper or not? But we found a few to do it. And she said tonight we were just going to have angel hair pasta. And then she marinates cherry tomatoes with Parmesan cheese in it and oil, cooks the pasta, and then throws that cold marinated tomato in top of it, and the pasta kind of heats it through. My goodness, is that scrumptious. Mm. And it's such a simple, quick meal. Mm-hmm. It really is a lovely one, and so it's become kind of one of our favorites. And so about every week we have it. And, well, I picked a lot of cherry tomatoes yesterday, and she says, perfect, we can have that dish again. And I said, that's good with me because I like it. And so a nice glass of red wine to go with it, and, you know, the day is complete. And so that's kind of what is on the menu for tomorrow or for tonight.
That does sound delicious. I wanted to just kind of a detour here.
Okay.
My wife and I have been we don't have a garden this year, so we depend on the supermarket, and we have not had good experiences with cucumbers this year. I don't know, of course, you probably grow yours, so they're probably great, but the cucumbers are kind of very hit and miss, the ones we've been getting.
Yep.
The flavor is just not horrible, but
not great.
What you would want. Yeah. I wonder what you think is causing that.
Well, two things I think cause it. One is the fault of the grocery store, and one of it is probably just the plants are – the whole western U.S. is where a lot of these are coming from right now that come into our market, and so it's been hot. And so when they get hot, we get these cucurbitaceans, which is a chemical compound in the plant that builds up in the skin, and the skin gets tough and it gets kind of bitter. And so those are stressors that show up in the crop. And then the other problem is that the grocery store keeps them in their cold room. And cucumbers are a warm weather crop, and they really prefer to be stored at temperatures at about 55 to 60. If we're going to keep them for any length of time. And if they're stored when it's colder than that, then they also take on some of these bitter off flavors. And so part of it is the grocery store always has them in the chiller section when they shouldn't be there. But they do that for a reason, because they stay longer. But when you get them home, they don't taste so good, and they often go bad pretty quick. So Dawn's like, the American-style cucumber, the dark green, smaller ones, she just has gone to buying the English cucumbers, and she only buys those, and we have less of a problem with them, because some of them are stored in the chiller, but some of them, if you look around the grocery store, are stored out on the floor by the other produce, where it's at kind of at room temperature, and that's a better place actually to store them. Then they have that plastic sleeve on them so they don't lose water, whereas the American-style green cucumber tends to have that heavier skin on it that is designed not to lose so much water. And so I think part of it is that. So maybe you just want to switch to English ones.
Okay.
And you'll find that that's a little bit better for you.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll take that tip. I'll report back to you.
Okay.
How we did.
Yeah.
So anything more on
harvesting
stuff.
Yes. Yeah, we didn't talk too much about harvesting stuff, and I don't know how much time we have because I don't see the clock too well. But if we have five or so minutes.
No, we've got some time, yes.
Okay. So a couple things that, you know, always give people trickiness. We know when a tomato is ripe. We kind of know when a pepper is ready to harvest. And in case of peppers, you can do it almost any time you want. They can be slightly immature and green. If you just wait a little longer, they'll color up. And so then you have the yellows and the oranges and the reds that you get in the grocery store. Those are just ones that are ripe versus ones that are harvested green. So it'd be like a green tomato or a red tomato. It's the same process. The ones that kind of give people the most hiccup is if you're harvesting melons. And so not everyone grows melons, but there are a lot of people that do. So how do you tell when a cantaloupe is ready? Well, the simplest way is, particularly if it's a netted cantaloupe, you look at where the stem attaches to the fruit. And if you see the stem starting to break away from the fruit itself, we call that abscising. So we're looking for the abscission zone. If you can then grab that fruit and then easily break it away without having to hold the stem and break it off, that melon is perfectly ripe. Mm. And so it should be consumed within the next day or two because it's perfectly ripe. Honeydews are a little bit harder if you're doing them. They don't break away from the stem, so they don't have the abscission zone. But if you're growing honeydews, what you do is you actually feel them. If you rub your hand on them, they will feel very smooth. And if you go to the grocery store and rub your hand on a honeydew melon, it always feels very smooth because they pick it way too early. Mm. And you want one that feels kind of sticky when you run your hand on it. It feels like it's got some, you know, sap or something like that on it. That's the natural waxes that the fruit produces, and that's an indicator of it getting ripe. But I even look for something different in my own garden. What I look for is I see little fine cracks that start to form in the skin. And if those little cracks are there, or if they're even starting to, you know, fissure out and break open a little bit more, that melon is perfectly ripe. That's when you want to pick them. And so you can't really pick them by color. You're just picking them by feel and by if you can see micro cracks. So if you're in the grocery store or if you're at the farmer's market, always look for one, feel them with your hand. Just rub your hand over them. If they feel really sticky, that's a good sign. If you can see little cracks in them, almost like hairline cracks or the spider cracks, if you get a crack in your windshield, that kind of stuff is what you're looking for. And then you're going to get a much, much riper melon. And it's going to have a lot more sugar in it. And you're going to go, oh, that's what a honeydew melon is supposed to taste like. Mm-hmm. Now, watermelon is a different one again. So what you're looking for is the stem doesn't break away. But right next to the stem is a little appendage that looks kind of like a pigtail, and that should be brown and dried out. Then you look at under the where the ground sits, where the melon sits on the ground. We call that the ground spot. It should be creamy to yellow in color. And then you look at the striping that's on the melon, and you should have very sharp contrast between them. If it looks like a more uniform background, so that it's going from light green to light green to light green, then that's usually an indicator that it's immature. But if you see a dark green, light green, dark green area, that's a sign that it's more mature as well. Mm-hmm. And so watermelons are hard to pick. We go to the grocery store. We don't have very many choices. We have lots of choices. So just look at the ground spot and then also look at the contrast between the stripes.
Okay.
And if the more contrast, better.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that specific question. So that's good intelligence. I'm always lost. Everybody thumps. I don't know what to listen for.
The thump doesn't do anything because you don't know what to listen for. Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
So I see people standing around the bins of watermelons, and then they finally just kind of put up their hands and they grab one and throw it in, and then you go home. I even have trouble sometimes when I do that because I like to have that third indicator, which is that tendril.
Yeah.
And I don't see that because they cut them off right at the fruit.
Yeah.
And so you just have to kind of, the more yellow that base spot is and the more contrast, the better.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. I'll try to do better. It's kind of luck of the draw.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, you go, wow, that was a good one. And the next time you go, wow, that was a bad one.
My dad always used to joke. He never did it, obviously, but he used to joke, well, the way to test is take a pocket knife in there.
It actually is.
Sample it. First, we won't do that.
Yeah, but we got one the other day, and Dawn thought it was fantastic. Yeah. I thought it was just kind of average. But the other thing is, within a watermelon, most of the sugar is right in the heart area or the very middle. Once you get outside that seed area, also toward the rind, the sugar levels drop. And so when you're eating close to the rind, you know, it just starts to taste a little bit more bland.
Yeah.
And that's just the nature of the way the sugars are deposited within those fruits. And so if you can buy one at your local farmer's market or at a fruit stand across northern or central Utah, you know, go to the fruit stand because those guys know what they're doing.
Mm.
I mean, they have been doing it for years. They know what a ripe melon is supposed to be like. They don't want to pick bad melons because people come in and complain, and then they have to give them another melon. They want them to come in and buy another melon, not just give them one because they got a bad one. So they're very careful about picking them. You go to the grocery store, it's kind of a coin toss, I always say. Mm. You might get a good one out of the bin, you might not, and that's just the nature of it.
It's high stakes because there's nothing better than a good watermelon.
Oh, there's really nothing better. Good, yeah. So we picked one yesterday, like I said, and I cut half of it up. And what I do is I usually take that little bit around the rind, and then I just run it through the juicer and maybe add a little bit of sugar or something like to it to just give it a little bit of more sweet flavor. But actually, it was really pretty good all the way to the rind. And so, I mean, even I have trouble sometimes picking good ones. I'm good about 75% of the time. But sometimes, you know, the bin is the bin, and you just, the luck of the draw.
It is fun socially because it can be a conversation starter because you got a bunch of people around the watermelon bin, and you're all thumping and you're all shrugging.
So
and,
what do you, hear? I hear a dull sound. I hear, some people say it needs to sound dull. Some needs a hollow. Some need.
And nobody knows. Right?
And nobody knows.
Yeah. Well, these are good tips. Dan, we do have a question via email here. Here's the question. Is there any way to prevent blossom end rot on the first tomatoes that produce? Is there one variety that's better at preventing that?
I think all of them are prone to it. So that's the first thing is, no, there are no varieties. The second thing I want to tell you is make sure that as soon as you start seeing those early blossoms, because it's usually the first ones that are there, the root system isn't as big. Do not let water stress occur on the plant. So I'm very careful when I start seeing the first flower trusses getting ready to open up the blooms that I make sure that I give that plant a really good soak, and that if it's a hot period, I give it an extra soak so that you have plenty of water in the root system. Because you got to remember that plant is maybe only 18 to 24 inches tall, and you already got a flower that's showing up. And those are the ones that always seem to have blossom end rot on it. And then once a root system gets bigger and bigger, it's occupying more space in the soil, it can gather more water from that, then you have less of an issue later on in the season. And you also say, well, it's a bigger plant, I need to water it more. So sometimes we just short-side ourselves on the amount of water that we give the plant when it's little, thinking that, it's okay. It looks good. It's not showing wilting. It's not showing leaf curl. It's not showing leaf roll. So it's okay. But the flower is fairly sensitive to water because that's a really tiny little organ that has to share water with the rest of this big plant, and the water gets shorted there, and then the blossom end rot shows up. So yeah, just water carefully early on, and then you should be good because that tends to be where we see it. So,
is there any one variety?
I have not yet seen any varieties that are blossom end rot free.
Okay,
they don't market them because they all get it.
Yeah.
And it comes back to just being careful with your water.
Yeah. All right, let's take another break. We'll come back with our final segment with Dan Drost, gardening expert. He's emeritus professor and horticulture and extension vegetable specialist in the Department of Plants, Soils, and Climate at Utah State University. Contributes to segments such as The Green Thumb, and he's giving us gardening advice. Here's how you can reach us: by email to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com, or call us, 435-797-8877, 435-797-8877. That's 435-797-8877. More following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have gardening expert Dan Drost with us, and we'd love to have him answer your question You can call us to 435-797-8877, 435-797-8877, or email us to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. Sudan, I know you wanted to return to water.
Yeah.
At the end of the program, we began the program with that, ended the program here. Give us some more tips.
Well, you know, I think the main thing that you have is one of the things that I always think about for my own landscape, and being a homeowner, you have to set priorities. One of the things Dawn and I were consciously doing this year was to make sure that, you know, kind of rather than just wash any hand washed material in the sink, we kind of did it in a collection container of some sort so that we collected that extra water that was there that I could then use in the landscape. And the place that I put it on is I do water my lawn. Don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating that we just turn off the water in our landscapes, because all one needs to do is drive around any village or town or community that you're in, and you'll see landscapes that have not been irrigated, and they look terrible, and the trees look terrible. And so there's priorities. To me, the garden is one priority because you've invested time and effort in it. You went out and purchased plants, or you raised plants, you bought seed, you turned it over, fed it somehow with manures or with the fertilizers and those kinds of things. So you invested something in this. So the priority for me is I invest a lot of time in my garden. I therefore care for my garden at a higher level than something else. Lawn to me is just something that's there, and so that's a low priority in my landscape. So I always work at turning the water level down on it to maintain some color, but not to worry about a brown spot or some discolored leaves or something like that. I don't need a lush northern, East Coast type of lawn where they're getting rain all the time and it's thick and lush and green. That's not my priority. The other priority I have is my largest trees. They are been there for a very, very long time. And so I always make sure that if it's super dry and they're in an area that's getting a little of that water, I tend to supplement that water with a deep soak once a month. So big trees are really critical to me. Things like perennial plants, particularly because I have a lot of natives, I don't worry about them nearly as much, but I do supplement them maybe with a irrigation event or something like that about every couple weeks. And that's a priority. Now, a major priority is if you put in something new. So last year, my peach tree died. Okay, so the peach tree came out. I got a new peach tree this spring. I put it in, and so I'm watching it carefully. And so I give it about some water every week because I want that tree to get well established. I had one of my arborvitas die on me, and it was in the hedge. And so when I pulled it out, I prepped the site, and I've been watering it more than I normally would water my hedge. Simply because the rest of the hedge is very well established, but that's a new planting, and I want that thing to survive, and I want it to get through this first year so that it can grow out its roots into the soil. And next year, I'll probably supplement it less, but I'll still supplement it. And then after that, it'll pretty much be itself. So you got to set priorities. And priority one for me, my garden, I invest a lot of time in. Any new plantings, I invested time and money in those, so keep those going. Big trees, because they are so important in my landscape to keep the house cool or keep sections of the yard cool. And then perennials and those kinds of things. And then finally, my lawn. That may not be everybody's priority, but that's my priority. Mm-hmm. And so you have to decide your priorities, and you just have to say, what have I invested the most in? I don't invest much in grass. Actually, not investing in the grass is a good thing because I only mow every other week. So I don't bother with a lawn service. I just do it myself because it's not much time and there's not much grass that grows because it's a little dry. Now, as we get these fall rains or as it cools down, that'll change. That grass just suddenly recovers, interestingly enough. And so it's very resilient, much more resilient than one everyone believes. And we and by doing that, what I'm trying to do is save water as well.
We just have a minute or two left. Got another question from a listener.
Yeah.
How can I contain my pumpkins so they don't take over the entire garden?
Don't grow pumpkins. Okay. Now this listener doesn't want to hear that as their answer because they want to do that. So one of the things one can do is, you know, just try to train, put them in an area and train them away. So if they're up against a fence or something, you know, you kind of pull the vines so that they're growing into another area. And when I used to grow a few of the winter squashes, which I no longer do because they, like you, I have a small garden. They take up a lot of space. I would train them through my perennials, and then the fruit would be out there someplace. And yeah, it didn't look very nice, but it just kind of gave me some space because they do take up an enormous amount of space. Each plant probably occupies about 20 square feet, if you think about it. Even maybe some cases, some of these pumpkins, even more. So if you're a big garden, find a place that's out of the way and just put them out there. Run some drip line to them or something like that, because all you need is a dripper close to the plant and you got enough water for that thing, and then just let it go. The other approach is take it out of your garden because it takes up too much space, and then go to your local farmer's market or to your local fruit stand or vegetable stand. In the fall, they have all the pumpkins and all the squash that you can ever imagine, and they're no bother for the whole year. All you do is here's a nice pumpkin. I'll take it home and do that. And so space to me is important, so I optimize space. I never grow things that take up too much space because I'm short on space. Mm-hmm. And so you have to think about it that way.
Okay.
All right.
Well, we're out of time here.
Oh, my goodness, Tom.
Just want to do one more plug. I'm sure you would as well for USU Extension.
Absolutely.
USUExtension.usu.edu. All kinds of advice, tips. And
everything from your animals to your garden to your finished products to, you know, canning and storage and all of that stuff. You know, Extension's got it all. Just go there. And if you're in Wyoming or if you're in Idaho and listening, I mean, these things are applicable to you as well. You don't have to come to Utah's site, though you can. You can just go to Wyoming's site or Idaho's site. They have all of that information available pertinent to your community. And so that's the important thing.
All right. Well, gardening expert Dan Dross has been with us. Dan, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure being here. Thanks, Tom.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.